welcome to the Transmedia Podcast. This is me, Robert Pratton, and you can find me online as Rob Pratton. And with me today, I've got David Varela, a very well-respected writer and Transmedia producer. And David's just done an awesome project, which I'm very delighted he's able to share with us. So, David, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on. So this was a bit of an unusual project for me. Pretty much every project I do seems to be a bit of a first and a bit of an unusual one. This one was a really interesting odd mix of sort of games and theatre and TV and technology, which I guess is of all things that interest me. It's a project called Framed, which it came about because I was approached by a guy called John Ormond, who works at a social media agency called Social Life. And John knew me or knew my work from theatre, actually. And he approached me because he knew I was interested in games and detective stories in particular. I did a bit of work with the Sherlock team recently. And he had a client at Social Life who were Alibi, the TV channel that's part of the UK TV group, and they just show wall-to-wall police procedurals, detective dramas. If you want a good murder, that's where you go. And they were launching a new detective series called Crossing Lines, and to mark that occasion, they wanted to do something a bit special, and John's idea was to try and do a sort of live-streamed escape room. And, well, I mean, the escape room phenomenon, I imagine, Rob, you're very aware of escape rooms and how they've sprung up around the world.
Well, I am, but I think it's worth taking a little bit of a diversion to explain to people what it, just in case there's anyone listening who's been in a cave for a couple of years or you know, on a different planet or something, who might not know what an escape room experience is. So what would it normally be if I walked down a high street and ran into one?
If you've been living in a cave for a couple of years, you've probably turned it into an escape room.
It might be a very cosy cave that you don't want to get out of.
Escape rooms are, again, a sort of mixture of almost like video game style gameplay and immersive theatre, really. Generally speaking, they are a single room that you walk into. Usually it's a sort of team exercise, so there'll be a few of you who are locked inside a room, and they have a ticking clock, usually about 60 minutes, to figure out a series of clues and find their way out of the room again to escape the room. And usually they are quite strongly themed. There's normally a bit of sort of theatrical narrative setup behind it all, and they may or may not involve live actors as well. So you might well have somebody sort of introducing you to the space. They may even be in the room with you for the duration. But generally speaking, they are quite sort of standalone setups where you get pushed into the room and you have to use your ingenuity and skills to find your way out again.
Would it be fair to say that these are really sort of puzzle solving quests? So once you're in the team, you know, sometimes you could, although it is sort of good sort of corporate training type thing, it could be that you're in there with strangers, and the idea is that different people among you have got different skills. Someone might be good at sort of solving a lock puzzle or something, and other people might be good at solving a number puzzle. And although you've got the sort of world building bit that you're in a particular space, there's not really a narrative that unfolds in the same way that you'll describe for your project.
Well, they do vary. Some escape rooms are designed really as just, you know, you pretty much walk in and there's a set of puzzles sitting on a table and you have to solve, you know, 8 out of 10 of them in the time to be for the door to be unlocked. They can be that kind of, if you like, narrative free.
Right.
Or they can be very, very story-led, and, you know, you are following, you know, really sort of following a trail of narrative storytelling clues that maybe help you understand the wider world that you're supposed to be in, and ultimately, yeah, tell you a bit of a story of your adventure. So there really is quite a wide range. Certainly the ones which I think are the most effective are the ones that really put a bit of effort into the world building and give you a real sense of character, literally. And the ones that sometimes can feel a bit sparse are the ones that really just give you a pile of puzzles and leave you to figure it out. But you know, my background is as a writer. I'm you know, a bit of a story geek, so I like something that's got a proper beginning, middle, and end, and a bit of tension and a bit of plot. So that might just be my preference, but certainly it seems to me those are the ones that are the most kind of creatively successful.
And so there's sort of like the mission, were you choose to accept it from social life, was take this concept and transfer it to something online.
And yeah.
How did that sort of, you know, so what did that look like? It's worth saying what the user experience, if I was a TV viewer, a fan of Alibi TV, what would I actually see? How do I engage with this concept?
Yeah, well, we had to, in order to make it work for a large online audience, we had to really sort of modify the model quite significantly from a normal escape room. For a start, the puzzles in the escape room tend to be designed for several people to be solving at once. So they might need, you know, literally three or four people to be holding something at the same time for it to be workable, or there might just be a series of puzzles where there are too many for any one person to do within the time, so people need to be working in parallel. Now, for us, because we had certain sort of technical limitations and opportunities that came with trying to live stream this escape room exercise. So because it was going to be single camera, all happening live, we really could only have one person in the room. We could have an actor effectively wearing a head camera in this space, and the audience would be watching that video stream live, and through the Facebook Live platform, their live streaming video platform, the audience could comment, send messages, and take part in polls, sort of short votes, to help direct that actor. So they were getting, they were effectively in the head of our main character, who was trapped in this room, and they were advising them, deciding how they should act, what they should perhaps focus on, maybe coming up with ideas or answers to problems that our main character was encountering. So rather than having puzzles that relied on having multiple people in the space, and that maybe were very physical, so often in escape rooms they have these sort of skill-based challenges that are, you know, effectively trying to hit a target from across the room, or doing something that's quite sort of it's a physical challenge. That isn't something that would really be an effective challenge for our online audience who are removed from it. So we made sure that any challenges were very visual, at least, so something that they could sort of figure out just by looking at things through their video screen, or that required that would encourage a bit of debate between our online audience. You know what it's like when you've got several hundred people online at once trying to make a decision. That was half the fun. Half the fun was setting up fairly interesting decisions for them to figure out, sort of debate between them what they thought the best course of action was. So we deliberately created puzzles and challenges that fitted that kind of model of having, you know, hundreds of people trying to figure something out together, rather than and then one person carrying it out in the room, rather than having multiple puzzles in parallel or having physical things that's really only fun if you're hands-on in the space. So as far as the audience was concerned, everything they saw and heard came via it was actually Alibi's Facebook page. They have quite a well-followed Facebook page, and we used Facebook Live to broadcast directly from there. And that meant that, well, we had a day and date opening. We were broadcasting live from 8 p.m. precisely, and we got people to turn up on the dot of 8 o'clock to see the action unfolding, and they had to escape before 9, which was happened to be the time that this new TV series that they were broadcasting was going to be on telly, so we wanted to make sure that the game was over, hopefully with a successful ending, by the time 9 o'clock came round.
And so I'm trying to pretend we've not talked about this before. So you mentioned, like, sometimes when you're setting these things up, there's a big discussion about, well, if he's in this room on his own, how is he checking out Facebook to see what people are telling him? So how did you approach, how did you get around that?
There's there were two ways of going about this, really. You either work out a premise where Facebook is very much part of it, and you have a character who's plugged into Facebook and requires Facebook, and you know, Facebook is prominent in it. Or you're bold, which is what we decided to do, and just say, you are this character, you are in this situation, and you are having to get yourself out of it. And we just kind of almost glossed over the technology, glossed over the mechanism, and just assumed that people would suspend the disbelief and go with it. And they did, which was a relief. We found that nobody really started disputing, you know, why is this guy using Facebook? If he's using Facebook, why can't he just, call for help to anybody else? Why are they talking to us? People just accepted the premise and went with it without really questioning it. And that's, I think, just the only sensible way to go. Otherwise, you end up bogged down in conversations about, why are you using Facebook? Can you send me a private message? All of this stuff which just gets awkward. We just decided that was the premise, and people. Just, I think, because we were confident about it, people accepted it.
I think as well, a lot of people are familiar with first person shooter type games. You know, no one questions the fact that they're sort of sat in their living room with on the sofa with a sort of games controller as you're steering someone around a location. So I guess it, in some regards, it feels a little bit like that you're controlling someone, and you just get on with it.
Yeah, and I think people are, like you say, people are used to that kind of video game POV, and so they sort of saw it as a bit of an evolution of that. The tricky bit was, from that point, once we had these kind of technical constraints, we'd figured out, what sort of content we needed within the story, what kind of puzzles, and what the mechanism we had for the audience communicating with sort of their avatar, if you like, our main character. We had to figure out a suitable setting and a suitable story. And part of that came from, the stylistic requirements of Alibi, the TV channel, the client, and partly through necessity and budgetary constraints. So Alibi, understandably, wanted something that had a sort of detective theme to it. They wanted something, preferably some kind of murder mystery, because that's their bread and butter and what their TV audience really enjoys. So we came up with an idea for a murder story. They had this wonderful term. They said they wanted something that was soft murder. It just meant no blood and gore, no decapitations, nothing too grim. But poisoning is good. Maybe a sort of a light stabbing. preferably even better. The violence is over, and you just find a corpse. And so that's
right.
That's the kind of the premise we got to was, you find a body and you're trapped in that room, and you have to clear your name effectively before the police turn up. The other constraint that we had was we had very little budget. We didn't really have enough budget to get a fancy, well-dressed, sort of intricate and beautiful venue. But what we could get was access to some empty studio space in the UK TV office building in Hammersmith. And we took a look at the available rooms, and what we found was they had a couple of very nice, clean, white studio spaces, which lend themselves very well to being dressed as something like an art gallery. It was just a white cube space. So that strongly influenced the direction we went with in terms of the plot and the setting. We thought, okay, it's going to be an art gallery because that's easy for us to dress. And it also means that the objects in the art gallery, the works of art, are things that we can really put some time into producing. And those, you know, each of those pieces of art was a puzzle in itself, was a part of the plot, was part of the challenge. And having very colourful objects in a white space makes that very clear. There was none of the... There's a bit of a fear in a lot of escape rooms that if you do... If you build a beautiful, realistic theatrical set, then people will spend all their time rummaging through drawers and, you know, admiring the decor, and won't actually be able to spot where the puzzles are, where the sort of the aim of the game is. By having a very white space with a few objects in it, it actually made it sort of very clear in terms of gameplay what people should be focusing on, rather than letting them get too distracted with stuff. So that kind of worked in our favour.
Really good. And how did the let's call him the actor, like the audience avatar, how did he navigate that space? Did they say to him, oh, what's that over there? You know, go right into that far corner, where narratively speaking, you might have wanted him to stay in the near corner, for example. How did you manage the story that you wanted to tell with their interaction?
There's quite a big team behind the scenes helping to coordinate the action. So as well as the guys from Social Life, the agency, we also had a team from a company called Groovy Gecko. And they are the specialists in video streaming and basically running the Facebook Live platform. They've worked a lot with Facebook. And so they were able to make sure that we weren't going to have any problems with bandwidth, to make sure that they were also involved in some of the moderation and sort of automated sifting of comments as they came in, to make sure that the most relevant ones were flagged up to us, so that the director, who was Minket, who's a producer who has run escape rooms in London and in Portland, she was able to sort of get a digested view of what the audience was saying, so then she could, by microphone, relay to an earpiece in the actor's ear actions for them to conduct. So if a lot of people in the Facebook audience were saying, go and have a look at that object on the left, those comments would be filtered through to Mink. She would relay them to her actor, and the actor would then be able to know that they should go to the left. So it was a bit of a roundabout route, but it meant that our actor could be hands-free. They didn't need to be looking at a screen. Everything was coming through an earpiece, and all sort of channeled through Mink as the directorial voice, if you like. So all of the input that was coming in from online ultimately went through her to the actor. Alongside that, for, I guess, to help us deliver some more narrative and to keep things a bit more entertaining, we had the voice of our main character. The main character is a security guard in this art gallery who gets locked in there after hours and realizes that he's been framed. He's been set up with this dead body on the floor to make it look like he's the murderer, and he's only got a short time to clear his name. So we had an actor called Dan Ford, who's a fantastic improviser and very smart, funny guy. And he was the interior monologue, if you like, the interior voice of our security guard. So he was the one articulating, if you like, the rules of a game to some extent, saying, oh, no, that door is locked. I can't get out of that door anymore. I've just tried it. It's really locked. And so he was able to sort of, pardon the pun, frame the problems and help direct the action and help to really sort of give character to our main character. I'd written probably, I don't know, 30 or 40 little sort of chunks of script, little sort of paragraphs of dialogue and monologue for him to reveal at key points. So when he was finding particular bits of information, when certain puzzles were solved, he was able to deliver a sort of pretty much a scripted monologue just to get across any key information. So, oh, that's the owner of the gallery. He's my boss. I know his background. He's a bit of a slimy piece of work, that sort of thing. So it's allowed us to communicate clearly to the audience a bit of background and give them that sense of a wider world and to help keep them on track if they ever really were trying to divert us from the spine of the story. Then we had several things to keep them back on track. So we had Mink's direction could tell the actor not to walk in that direction. But we also had Dan there as a kind of failsafe as well, saying, I think we really should be focusing on this piece over here. And it meant that it felt like a bit more of a realistic character than if it was just a completely mute sort of pair of eyes that you're looking for. And all you were getting, you know, the only interior you would have seen of their mind would have been this rapidly moving Facebook comment stream. At least with Dan's voice there, he felt like a bit more of a human.
No, I think that's a really good thing, and it is quite like computer games in a way, because you will get other characters trying to nudge you in a certain direction if they think you're wasting their time.
Yeah, I mean we were. Yeah, those many chunks of script that I wrote, several of those weren't used because they were contingencies. They were for if something went wrong in the room, if you know something got broken, or if there were several points in the story where we would host these Facebook polls where they would have a sort of a binary or a three-way choice for what they thought our security guard should do, and for each of those options, there was a particular outcome, and we'd go with whatever the poll dictated. So, yeah, there were sometimes parts of the story that were effectively unused because the audience chose a particular path.
Yeah.
But in every case, we always were, you know, ultimately steering them back to the sort of the main spine of the story, if you like, because especially I think with a murder mystery story, if you don't find out who done it, if you run out of time, if you fail, if you don't reach the last page of the Agatha Christie novel, then it's really unsatisfying. So we wanted to make sure by the time we got anywhere near 9 o'clock, our audience were going to get an answer to this murder mystery, and hopefully successfully clear the name of themselves, of our hero. And that is actually how it turned out. The pacing worked out pretty well. I think we were the police turned up and just about cleared our security guard's name by about 8:50, I think. We had 10 minutes spare, which was perfect, really. Gave everyone time to put the kettle on, make a cup of tea and sit down in front of the new series of Crossing Lines at 9 p.m. So, yeah, mission accomplished there.
I was going to ask, did you use the poles as kind of like tent poles in your narrative? Did you use that to sort of to pace basically?
Each one was sort of a pivotal decision. It was, you know, So it's a proper kind of go left or go right. And we certainly made it feel like those decisions had meaning. We started off with a very simple kind of tutorial, really, in the first couple of minutes, where the security guard was trying to decide whether he wanted to have a cup of tea or a cup of coffee. And that was not a momentous decision at all, but helped the audience get to grips with this idea that this is the control system. This is one of the ways they can influence the action. So there was that very simple choice at the end, at the start, but by the end, probably the most important, the most interesting decision they had to make was there was a vase with a key inside it, and we needed to get the key. Probably we're thinking that key might be really helpful, but we also knew that just moving that vase would trigger an alarm, which meant the police would be there within about 2 minutes. So there was a sort of reasonably tense debate and decision to be made about whether they smashed that vase or not. And ultimately, yeah, it was a fairly close vote, and it did ultimately lead to them successfully finding out who'd done the murder and successfully clearing the security guard's name. So, yeah, the decisions got more important as the story went on, and we did give them, I think it's about one every 10 minutes during the course of that 40-45 minutes story. And we did have to give them a bit of space anyway, because each poll took a little while to conduct. You had to kind of set up the problem and then give people enough time to think about it, maybe chat about it, place their vote, close the votes, and then they're all sort of automatically tallied up, and then we have a decision. So we didn't want to have too many of those moments, because it does sort of slow things down a little bit. And this was a tense ticking clock situation. We didn't want there to be, we didn't want our hero to be stopping every 2 minutes to, you know, consult with the group about every little thing. We needed it to be meaningful moments of drama where actually dwelling on them maybe would add to the tension rather than dissipate it.
And did you rehearse it much, or how many times did you rehearse it to get that sort of pacing right?
Not very much. We had a couple of goes on the day and the day before. We actually did some slightly different run-throughs with a few members of the press who came in individually, and rather than present them with the Facebook interface, if you like, rather than having them typing in comments and voting using these polls, what we did was we gave them Minc's headset, effectively. So they had the microphone. They were talking directly to the actor in another room in the gallery space, and so they had a slightly different experience of how it worked. It was, I guess, a bit more like a sort of first-person shooter experience, where it was kind of one person controlling one avatar.
Right.
But that gave us a chance to run through at least the first 10 minutes of the story to see how that worked out. And it was one of those not entirely ideal situations where your press night is your rehearsal, if you like. So we were using the run-throughs with the journalists as a bit of a dry run for ourselves. Fortunately, it seemed to go pretty well, and one of the real successes of the whole project was actually the press that came out of it. Got some really good PR, and it's ended up turning up in a few mainstream publications like The Guardian, which was really quite a coup for something that was just designed as an online experiment, really, to see if it could work.
No, but I think it's creatively innovative as well, isn't it? So it's a classic win for this type of sort of storytelling stroke sort of marketing material. It's neither one nor the other. I mean, it's been paid for, presumably from a marketing budget to promote the show, but you've not gone into it like you're making an advert. You're making an experience for an online audience, and so that's why it gets the PR coverage.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair chunk of my work, of my creative work, has been brand funded. So I'm not snobby about that. But it was interesting to start to work on a project where the PR coverage was pretty much the primary concern, and the as well as social life, the PR company involved called Taylor Herring did seem to do a particularly good job of getting the right people in and really giving it a much higher profile than I would have expected for a little online experiment where I probably worked on this for less than a week,
and it's, oh wow,
probably got more press than anything.
Yeah. Well, maybe it just depends on the strength of the idea and the execution, and not the budget. But don't tell anyone that. That's not. But tell me. When we spoke before, you were saying about some of the complications, if you want to call it that way, of doing one of these live broadcasts and accommodating people that were, you know, interacting on different devices. Talk about that a bit, Dave, because I think that's fascinating.
It was certainly one of the learning experiences that we had working with Facebook Live was especially around things like these polling moments where you're trying to get your whole audience to consider a question fairly quickly and feedback fairly quickly so that you can move the action on. We found that video lag was the enemy, and it really caused us a few problems. On some platforms, on desktop or laptop, the lag on Facebook Live video between, you know, the time between something actually occurring and your audience seeing it on their computer is about 15 seconds. But if they were using a mobile or tablet device, just because of the way video is broadcast, it's sort of sent in packages, which requires a certain amount of caching before it's sent on, it causes a bit more of a delay. And so on mobile, somebody using a mobile in the same room as somebody watching it on a desktop might be seeing things delayed by 30 or even 60 seconds. So we had to take into account that difference when we were setting up these polls and just asking people questions in the Facebook chat, because that was operating not entirely in sync with the video. So we might ask somebody a question in the chat. If they were watching on desktop, they'd wait 15 seconds to see what we were talking about on the video. If they were on mobile, it would be perhaps up to a minute before they saw what we were talking about. So that did cause not just delays in the action, but it meant that when we were hosting a poll, we might open it up to our audience, say, okay, start voting now. It might take 60 seconds for somebody using a mobile to see that, and then it would take them a while to think about it, feedback, place their vote. And it meant that every time we wanted to ask one of those sort of polling questions, we'd have to allow maybe 2 minutes in total so that everybody would have a chance to participate. And that was a bit of a problem in this particular type of narrative, because it was a ticking clock story, because everything was supposed to be very urgent and very intense. Having to wait that long for a decision to be made did kind of slow things down. It did make it feel like the action sort of ground to a halt a bit when we reached those points. So that's when Dan Ford came into his own as our narrator, helping to paper over some of those gaps and really keep people involved. And actually, you could also see the polling data, you'd see these little bar charts going up and down as the polling information came in. So there was some visual interest during those sort of 2 minute periods. But yeah, it would have been much better for us, I think, if all the video had been in sync across all platforms and we had less lag to deal with, because we could have just kept that sense of urgency, kept this idea that our main character wasn't just the kind of guy who would freeze for 2 minutes while trying to make up their mind. We could actually, I think, keep it slicker. So, yeah, if anybody is planning a Facebook Live interactive project where they're going to be relying on input from the audience in real time, then bear in mind it's not quite real time. There's a bit of a delay, and you might have to build that into your plans.
What might you do next time? Because like 2 minutes is quite a long time to sort of tread water while you're waiting for the next thing to go on. I mean, like, do you think, I don't know, you might have like, it's an art gallery, but you could have stuff for him to go and look at or ponder on. You know, like, it's almost got like, like you can't just stand there whistling in the air waiting for that tap in his foot. So what? How do you think you might compensate next time?
I guess you just need to set up the question nice and early and have a sort of parallel bit of action that you can be getting on with in the meantime. So
make it more fluid, would you say? So rather than have like these sort of breakpoints, just make it, you know, it comes up, people vote, and then he sort of more seamlessly sort of navigates the different spaces, perhaps.
Yeah, so just rather than you reach a point in the plot where it cannot move forward until this decision has been made, just write the story or have a, if you like, a B plot that you can be getting on with while that decision is being made. And then once it's made, you can return to it. So just have, I guess, and probably not create a story that is quite so time pressured, because it did highlight really the delays. So yeah, I'm sure that you could do a slightly more leisurely paced sort of two stranded story and make it feel a lot more natural.
No, even so, it's fascinating. I think it's really really interesting. So. So, David, what are you working on now, and how can people get in contact with you?
I have an interesting set of projects at the moment. One, incidentally, is an escape room, a true escape room project, which I can't say too much about. But I'm also working as a screenwriter, old-fashioned screenwriter, on a TV drama project in Scandinavia. So I'm off to Stockholm in the morning to talk about a story there. And I'm also working on a virtual reality drama, hopefully a drama series about human trafficking, which is hopefully going to be very hard-hitting. We're doing a lot of real-life research with survivors and with charity groups involved in the human trafficking across the US-Mexican border. And that's, I think, going to be quite a powerful piece and when it gets made.
I think we might find some hard murders in there rather than soft murders.
unfortunately, that's it is the truth of the situation. So that's what I'm up to at the moment. But there's always new things coming in, which is great. I'm always looking for interesting new projects too. And well, you can check out what I've done before on my website, which is davidvarela.com. That's VARELA.com. And on Twitter, I'm @writingstudio. So yeah, take a look. Feel free to get in touch if you have any interesting projects or if you'd like to chat about anything I've done.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, David. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.